I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast all about books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and on today's show, we're talking about All You Can Ever Know by Nicole Chung for the Stacks Book Club. Our guest is author and journalist Vanessa McGrady. There are spoilers on today's show, so if you want to read the book first and then come back, I highly recommend that. If you want to learn more about the book without any spoilers, check out my conversation with Nicole Chung on the Short Stacks from Monday, February 11th. If you listen and love The Stacks, you can get more from the show by joining The Stacks Pack and receiving inside access and perks like a virtual book club and more. Go to patreon.com/thestacks. You can contribute as little as $1 a month and rest easy knowing your money is going to support an independent podcast that you love. So check out The Stacks Pack at patreon.com/thestacks. If you prefer supporting the show with one-time contributions, go to paypal.me/thestackspod. To stay up to date on The Stacks, make sure you're following us on social media and going to the website www.thestackspodcast.com. Links to all of our social media accounts are found in the show notes. You'll also find links to everything we talk about on today's show. If you shop through these links, The Stacks earns a small commission and it comes at no cost to you. So that's a huge win-win. If you have a moment right now, I would love if you would rate and review the podcast. These reviews help us climb the charts and help us break through the algorithms to get new listeners. So if you haven't yet, I would appreciate you taking a moment to do so now. Our most recent review comes from Just Emily C., who says, "This podcast is new to me and already it's in my top 5 of the many podcasts I listen to. Tracy Thomas is one of the best interviewers in podcast-dom. I wouldn't even call it interviews. It's more like natural conversation. I love her curiosity and honesty. And most of all, I love all the books. Thank you so much, Just Emily C. We love the books here too. If you have a moment, go rate and review the show. It's so greatly appreciated and it really helps us getting new audiences and being able to book awesome guests. Now it's time for my conversation with Vanessa McGrady about Nicole Chung's memoir, All You Can Ever Know. All right, everybody, we are back again this week with author, journalist, Vanessa McGrady, and we're talking about All You Can Ever Know for the Stacks Book Club, which is written by Nicole Chung, and it's her memoir of her experience of being adopted and then going on a journey to find her birth family.
Birth family.
Yeah. So welcome back, Vanessa.
Thank you.
We'll just dive right in. Oh, I'll say this now. There's going to be spoilers this week, so if you haven't read the book yet and you care, then maybe don't listen and come back later. And if you don't care, that's fine too. You can listen up. So Vanessa, what did you think of the book?
I was really moved by this book. And I thought she just did such a beautiful job with her inner landscape mm-hmm. about these decisions and these feelings that she was having.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this book was really, it was very emotional and she was very vulnerable. And I felt like she did a great job of kind of, as someone, I will admit, who knows very little about adoption, the process, being adopted, all of those experiences, she really helped me to understand her process, which I'm sure is different for everyone. But she really was open in a way that allowed me to have the space to kind of think on it. And so I really liked that. And it just gave me a new perspective, a new way to see the world, which I always appreciate when someone gives me a little bit of space to try to, you know, think as I read. One of the things, I mean, right where the book, I think we should start right where the book starts, which is her mythology. She talks about like the mythology of her adoption. And in your book, Rock Needs River, you become a parent, and you talk a lot about that mythology kind of as well, with your daughter and what you tell Grace. And I just am interested about that.
I think that Nicole Chung did such a good job of balancing the mythology of, you know, what she had hoped to find mm-hmm. or what she was scared to find out versus the reality. And because, you know, usually when we have a lifelong belief or dream or thought, it doesn't always realize or materialize in the way that we think it will. Right. I mean, just look at like somebody who wants to grow up, get married, have a family. That doesn't always work out that way.
No.
And just the same as, you know, she has this, you know, these thoughts about being adopted and her birth family. And she did a beautiful job of just unfolding how she felt during every point of realization that she had.
Right. And so Nicole's adoption was a closed adoption. And since you have done so much work and writing on all of this, I would love for you kind of to explain the differences and kind of the I guess, mental challenges or emotional challenges that come up with an open versus closed adoption. Would you
sure.
kind of give a little
yeah.
background on those?
So, you know, way back in the day, for most of history, most adoptions were through kin. So, mm-hmm. you know, like if your sister died in childbirth and someone from the family would take the baby or raise the baby, or usually, you know, like way back in the day, a lot of times it was like someone in the community or someone in the family would raise mm-hmm. those children. During the Victorian age, when it became immoral to bear a child out of wedlock, it was like highly, highly immoral. And there was a lot of shame around that. And so at that time, more adoptions were closed, meaning that there was no contact between the birth family and the adoptive family or the mm. child. And that happened way up through the 80s, really. And
right.
a lot of birth certificates were stamped illegitimate or bastard on them. And then new birth certificates were issued if in the case that there was an adoption. And men, you know, there was a big, big gap in knowledge of when, you know, like how people could understand where they're from. A lot of children were not even told they were adopted,
right.
even though they knew in some ways they basically
right.
knew and, you know, on some psychic level that, or, you know, things just didn't add up that they were adopted. And it was really not until Alex Haley's Roots came out in the 70s. And so, you know, you have a whole generation of African-American people like realizing, you know, and like really taking action, not that they're realizing, but they're like finally taking action and having this like great activist movement to find out like, where did I come from? What
right.
country am I from?
Right.
You know, who are my ancestors? Where did I, you know, where did we grow?
Right.
You know, and that sparked a movement among adoptees. The same questions. Where am I from? You know, who am I exactly?
Right.
And so then a woman named Kathleen Silber became a great advocate for open adoption. And now that's the norm. It's different for every family. It's different for every situation. But now it's more common for there to be a level of contact or at least transparency between the birth family or the birth mother and the adoptive family.
And let me ask you this. In an open adoption, with that transparency between the birth mother and the adoptive family, how much of the conversation between the child knowing about their birth parent, is that left up to the adoptive family? Like, how much of that involves the child's knowledge of the adoption?
It's so much of it just depends on the family. You know, in some cases, there's probably things that you don't want your child to know, like, was it incest?
Right.
You know, was it a very dangerous situation?
Sure.
Was it rape? Like, again, there's so many.
Right. But I guess my question is, there's no part of open adoption that has like a stipulation about when the child finds out that they were adopted. Like,
well, no, I mean, it's just different.
It's just
different.
So there's no rules.
It's better. I will say that it is better for the mental health for the child to always know. You always hear from adoptees that found out much later, and it's very shocking to them,
right.
And it's disappointing. And it also erodes a level of trust between the child and the parents, even though the parents often meant well.
Right.
And they did it out of love because they didn't want their child to wonder or anything. But it's really just better for the mental health of everybody involved.
Yeah. That phrase, did it out of love, I feel like is kind of one of the major themes of this book. It's like that everyone's acting with their best intentions. And it's so interesting to think about like how intentions are really not. They're not a great guide for life necessarily. Like the good intentions don't always lead to good outcomes.
I was so mad at the mother for refusing contact. You know, she basically told the birth family she was not interested in talking to them when they tried to find out. And that was just such a huge selfish,
right?
Like, honestly, that was like a super, super selfish move,
yeah,
on her that scarred her daughter,
yeah. And Nicole talks about how I think she says it, or maybe this is what I extracted from it, was that there was a need from Nicole's mother to feel as wanted as she had wanted Nicole before Nicole was. Before she adopted Nicole, like that she wanted Nicole to want her in that same way, which I thought was really interesting because, of course, Nicole wouldn't have that want for her mother because she was always her mother for as long as she knows that was her mother, and her birth parents were never part of her life. So, of course, she doesn't have that longing for her because she was always there, but that insecurity on her mother's part was really, you know, kind of got in the way of Nicole's own growth and ability to understand her roots and her community. But I thought that was super interesting to think about.
It's sad. It's so sad, you know, and it is, I mean, it is basically that, you know, like you can't cage somebody like that.
I mean,
she basically kind of caged her.
Right. And she was, you know, scared. She, you know, thought that something bad might come of it, right? Like, of course, she wasn't trying to be, you know, do something bad, but that's that same thing is like these intentions are so, it's so subjective, I guess, is what I'm trying to say about intentions. And we think in the moment, like we've all made decisions where we're like, this feels like the right thing. I want this to work out. I want to do the right thing. And then in retrospect, you realize like that probably wasn't the best thing for me to have done.
It happens to me a lot.
Sure being a parent, that's a constant thing. You think you're doing the right thing by your child, and then you realize 6 months later or 5 years later, like, probably should have not done that, or should have done that, or whatever.
I feel like I'm wrong all the time.
Sure. We all are. We're all idiots, which is one of my catchphrases. So the book starts off with her talking about her adoption and like knowing all her life that she was adopted and that, you know, God had brought her to her parents, and there was angels, and there was, you know, this whole, you know, her family is Catholic, so it was very centered in things.
Mysticism.
Yes, yeah. Like, so angels and guiding and this and that. But why do you think that parents create these myths around their children? Like, where do you think that impulse comes from?
You know, I honestly don't know if it's mythology. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do feel like it was a very spiritual connection between me and my daughter.
Okay.
So I can't say that we create it just to placate them. But I feel like, you know, anybody, you know, when we can't explain something, you know, when you can't explain the sun moving across the sky and you're like an ancient Etruscan, you're probably going to say that's the gods moving the sky.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it just the same as, you know, you can't always explain what happens after you die. So we say we go to heaven.
Right.
And that's a mysticism. That's a mystery. And it's a mythology.
Right.
Do we know it's true? I don't know.
No.
I don't know. But same, you know, I think that's the same. Like we just rely a lot on mythology to explain things.
Right. Because as a parent, you don't know exactly what it was about you that made Grace's birth parents choose you. Like you have answers. You have questions, I guess, in that sense, especially in Nicole's book, like in Nicole's story, her parents really didn't know what the Chung saw in them or why, you know, so I guess that makes sense. You're kind of like filling in those gaps.
And I also feel like that, you know, the Chung family didn't have a lot, you know, like right now. So if there is a young, or they don't have to be young, if there is like a birth parent that needs to find a family for their child, they will be presented with 1,000 scrapbooks
right.
from an agency or a social worker
right.
that says like, well, these people, they live on a cul-de-sac and they have a golden retriever and they love to go to Disneyland,
right.
you know, like, so you'll have those, but I don't feel like the Chungs had that opportunity really.
No.
I mean, it feels like it's just like, oh, okay, where's the family? Okay.
Like
fine,
this worked out.
This worked. Our baby's sick. We can't.
So like there's that impulse to create something that feels more whole or like more, I guess just to put meaning behind things like you're saying, like we put meaning behind the sun or we put meaning behind like heaven or whatever. Just it feels more full than kind of like this happened.
Right.
And it's great. And we're so
right.
happy it happened. But like this happened.
Exactly.
I guess that's not a great story to tell a kid.
I do feel like Grace and I were spiritually connected.
Right.
In some way, I feel like we are the right, you know, we were meant to be together. So I do feel like that.
Right.
And, but also, you know, we were picked. We were
right.
picked by her birth parents. So
right. Both things at once. There's a phrase for the best that comes up a lot. And you talked about this last week when you were saying that, you know, people often talk about, birth parents and say like it's the most selfless thing to do or it's for the best or this and that. And Nicole kind of suggests that that really glorifies and simplifies something that can be very complicated and painful. I don't really have a question. I don't know.
You're right. Yes, you're right. And Nicole is right. And there's also I've heard from a lot of adoptees that feel like even if they had the shittiest parents in the world, they should have been kept. Like they regret. Like there's a lot of people who don't like adoption.
Right.
You know, so much of us are like, rah, rah, you know, you got a beautiful family. Everybody's so lucky. But really, like there's a lot of people out there who don't feel like that. And
right.
they just feel like no matter how shitty your family is, you should stay with them. And they wish that they had never been given up. I don't know if they would actually wish that if they, you know,
lived a parallel life.
Yeah, like a harrowing life. I mean, I don't know. Even at the end of the book, I don't know what Nicole Chung
right.
really would want.
In my reading, it felt like she loved her parents and loved her life and was grateful to have been adopted. I think, of course, there's always that sliding doors feeling of like, what if? But in my reading, I felt like she had the life she was meant to have.
I feel like she did. And I do feel like she really regretted just not having that contact with her
the
sister
information, yeah.
and the culture. She was really,
yes.
she felt like such an outsider.
Totally.
Being the only Asian
right.
kid or one of very few Asian
right.
kids in her community.
Right. And like, you know, she talks, I mean, there's a huge chunk of this book is about like this transracial identity, which I guess is a phrase that's often used with adopted children who have been adopted by people who are of a different ethnicity than they are. So their birth parents are a different ethnicity than their parents. And especially for her growing up in rural Oregon, where it was very white and her family was very white. I think she said they have like red hair. Like it's not like they're not like dark and kind of like maybe we're related, like, you know, or maybe I've seen some other Asian kids or like maybe I have some black friends. Like it's like white people and this Korean child. And I felt like it was super interesting that her parents did not want to engage with that at all. Like with that idea that she was going to be the only one in the community. Like that they, maybe they didn't feel equipped to have those conversations, but there was no, you know, hey, honey, you're Korean and that's beautiful. And
like all, I don't see color. We don't see right. color in this family. Right. And like when you talk to people who are transracially adopted, especially like black kids into white families, right. you see a lot of that anger and that disappointment that, right. you know, like our family doesn't see color. Well, guess what? Everybody like,
do
else
you see
does.
Me? Can yeah. you see me? Because
yeah,
I'm
having a different yeah. experience growing up than
right.
you did.
Right. Well, and Grace is, your daughter is Mexican.
She has some Mexican in her, some Jewish. Mm-hmm. We did the 23andMe.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. But she's, so I'm very Scots Irish, mm-hmm. A lot Scots Irish. And she is Scots Irish and also a little bit German too. And she's really psyched about the German part.
Interesting.
Yeah. She just really resonates with that. She does live a little bit of other things too. But
her birth father, he was Mexican.
He had spent time in Mexico. His birth mother may be
okay.
some part
I see.
Mexican or his yeah his mother there but there's just a lot that we need to fill in the blanks
right.
with them.
So that's not something that you, the transracial aspect isn't something
she
that
looks
you,
honestly she looks just like me.
She does
she
look
looks,
just like
she
you.
Looks a lot like yeah. me. We have the same color hair.
Yeah,
I changed mine a little bit but
to kind of enhance that.
But she is but we yeah I mean there's no way we'd walk down the street and you know
right.
like the people would think that she didn't come out of my hoo-hoo.
Yeah.
You know?
That's so interesting that it just – because, like, you never know. That's the thing I think that is for all parents. It's, like, you never know who your kid is. If you get a kid, you know, from having sex and you're pregnant and you carry a kid for 40 weeks, you still don't know anything more about who that kid is going to be than you do if you're picked from a scrapbook and birth parents say – you're the one. Vanessa, it's you. Like, you wouldn't have known any more about what kind of person Grace was, what kind of things excited her. You know, that's all so – it's, like, such a mystery.
I mean, look at big families. Like, right. most families have, like, the one weird brother, you
right.
know,
totally.
Or something. Or, like we don't know what happened with Susan,
right.
you know, or something.
I just think there's, like, more yeah. similarities to being a parent no matter what. The child came into your life than we give credit to, because I feel like adoption has so much stigma around it that it's like, oh, you know, it's like, but ultimately you're a parent.
I mean, it's potluck really, isn't
right.
it? I mean, yeah. it's like kind of potluck like that you like your family. It's potluck that you're going to like your name
right.
you're given.
Right.
It's potluck that you're going to get along with people.
Right. Totally.
You know, we don't know. You don't know.
Right. Right. It's so true. One of the things that Nicole talks about in the whole like transracial part of the book, it's throughout, but in the beginning she really talks a lot more about that, is how she's not only is she the only, you know, Korean person in the community, but she's also the only person of color that her family has any access or relationship to. And so that there's this obligation to be the voice of all people of color, which I just am like, whew, that's hard. You know, we talk so much about how in America, people don't see people who are different than them. And like, we're so homogenous, even if we live in a place like LA that's super diverse, like it's still, you know, white people are with white people and black people are with black people and Asian people are with Asian people. And to think that like you are the representative that people who don't come in contact with any other people of color have to go to, oh.
I mean, that's why people should read more. That's
yeah.
why you should read Between the World and Me.
Right.
You
know? No, it's true. It's why you need to read.
Yeah.
It's why, you know, but it just was like to think of that, like at the age of 5, at the age of 10, at the age of 15, like you're always that person in your family and that like you have to defend things. And like you were saying, you're micro bullshit. Like imagine how much of that day in and day out. Family gatherings, Christmas, like, holy moly, it's no good.
No, I mean, even just, you know, what's always shocking too is like that people feel like they have this kind of weird liberty, like strangers always have a weird liberty to say things.
Mm-hmm.
I recently did a story on what not to say to adoptive parents and, you know, especially like transracial adoptions. It's so crazy what people feel entitled to ask in front of children.
Like what?
Like, oh, was her mother a crack whore? Or, oh, was like, how much did you pay for her? Or like, and also like the ubiquitous, like you see like a black child with a white family. Where's she from?
Mm. Well, I get too.
Where's
I have
she
a
from,
white
from?
Mom. Yeah. I have a white mom and a black dad. And there were parts of this that I definitely related to. Like, I remember once my brother and I were out somewhere with my mom and they were like, oh, well, where are their parents? And my mom was like, me. And they were like, no, who's at, like, who are their parents? And she's like, it's me. Like, hi, how can I help you? But like, and I mean, and my mother is my biological mother. And even still, like, there's that disconnect when my dad wasn't around, like if he was not with us, that people would be like confused, you know, and like minimize our family, right? It's like that micro bullshit. Like, you're minimizing because it doesn't make sense to you.
And how did that feel
it
to you growing
dumb.
Up?
You it's hate like it. It's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that didn't happen to other families.
No, of course
you
not.
Know.
And I actually look just like my mom, which is like what's so crazy. Like, our faces are identical. Our skin tones are different. But like our smile, our face, we are like basically twins. And the older I get, the more I look like her. But yeah, it's really hard as a kid too, because you only know what you know until you're exposed to more things. So when you're, you know, 10... I didn't know necessarily. I mean, I guess I knew that some people's skin tones were the same as their parents, but you don't think that that's confusing for other people, because it wasn't confusing for me that I had a white mom and a black dad. But that then then when people come up to you and say things, then you're like, this is something's wrong with me. Like, I'm other. You start to feel
that. Right.
They put
like
feeling.
A separation.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny, when Grace was really little, we went to a friend's house. And that kid was adopted, a little boy, and in her preschool. And I was like, oh, did you know that he's adopted too? And she's like, you mean there's people that aren't adopted? Like, right. It was like, so it was just part of her worldview. Like, she didn't even think. And then cut to, and then she was like 3 or 4 then, and then cut to now where she's 7 and she's crying because she was the only adopted kid in her class. And she felt really,
wow.
You know, like
right.
Other.
Right. Because it makes you, my goddaughter, she, when she was younger, so she has, her mother is mixed like I am. So her grandmother is white, but her father is, both of his parents are black. And so when she was younger, she always thought that like black was like very cool. Like, she thought like, so if you were black, you were good. So she would be like, auntie's black and mommy's black and Grammy's black. And we'd be like, oh, Grammy's white. She's like, no, Grammy's black. Like, cause she just thought black meant like, could be friends with us, right? Like, she didn't realize that we were just like, that it was a description of color, and we all just like let it go because we were like,
that's
this
the
is
cutest
great
thing yeah. I've ever heard.
And now
that's
she
so
now
cute.
She's like 8 and she knows that Grammy's white and my husband's white, so like she, but she would say like Grammy and uncle are black, and we'd be like, okay, cool, we're down with that. But
that's
then there's
awesome.
Like a separation, and then it becomes, oh, we're different in different ways and this means something else and not great. But also, like you said, you see color, you do, you know. But she just didn't know that we were talking about color when we said someone was black. She thought we were talking about, like, if they were cool.
Well, also, if you think about a child and you talk, like, about a black person.
Right.
They think black. Like,
right.
The color black.
Right. The color black.
Like, the actual
right.
color black.
Exactly.
You
yeah.
know, like, I remember she, like, Grace was talking about, like, we did a lot of, like, reading about Martin Luther King and stuff. And mm-hmm. she talked about brown.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, that actually makes
Charlie
more sense.
Charlie says brown,
for
too.
Her.
Yeah. Because that's
yeah.
the color.
Yeah. The actual yeah. color.
Like,
yeah.
like the crayon. Do you guys have the crayon box that has, like, the colors, like, the skin cone colors?
We don't do crayons very
oh.
well in our house.
Oh, okay.
Like,
well,
crayons always kind of get destroyed.
That
yeah.
makes sense. Well, we, yeah. in school, we used to have, like, crayons. And then we had, like, the skin color crayons, and it had like peach and like, I don't know, cream.
Nude,
yeah. yeah, like different, you know, and then there would be like light brown and dark brown and like mahogany and like all these different colors that were the colors of skin and not just like black, white, and brown and yellow.
I mean, right? we're still like people are still struggling with that with like makeup and
sure.
underwear
sure.
and shoes. Like
and
what's,
pantyhose
like what's
and
nude,
tights. Yeah.
you know?
Nude is not a color that I can
I know
wear.
We're really digressing here.
It's fine. That's what we do yeah. here. It's, no one cares. Everyone's used to me just like talking about pantyhose.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
So one of the things that I thought was super interesting about her, she asked towards the end, is she appropriating Korean culture? And that like floored me. I read the sentence probably 10 times because I was thinking to myself, why would she ask that? And then I was like, oh, you know, it's, I started to make more sense to me. And then I was like, is she? And I don't think so, but I understand that feeling because she wasn't raised Korean. I'm putting that in air quotes because it's hard to say how you raise someone any one way. Like there's so many different ways to be Korean or whatever.
I mean, but would that be the same though? Like let's say like a black person raised in Ohio wearing a dashiki.
Right.
You know, like it's how you walk. I feel like she wasn't.
Right.
But
no,
it's not really for me to answer either.
I don't think that you can appropriate your own culture. Now, does it feel authentic to her personally? I think that's more of the question.
Yes.
But I don't think it's considered appropriation because that is her culture, whether or not she was raised in it and whether or not she's exploring it now in her 30s, I think is how old she is.
She's also walked through her life as an Asian girl and and then later an Asian woman.
Right. But she's experienced the world kind of in this like white point of view. She has her Asian point of view, but she also has like white she identified with white for most of her life culturally, but she has her Asian point of view. I mean it's really complex stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and also like, is it in the eye of the beholder?
Right.
Is it like I just know it when I see it?
Right. And it's hard. It's not only is it complicated, it's also I don't even feel like equipped to have the language to talk about it, which is it's why I'm like kind of stuttering so much today, because it's not something that we really talk about as a culture. Like I feel like I was saying earlier, adoption and the idea of adoption has been so stigmatized that we kind of like have silenced so many people who are part of the adoption triad, from birth parents to the children, that it's like we don't even – there's so many – I have to imagine with how global adoption has become, there are so many children who are transracial and that like – I don't even have the words to explain it. It kind of like breaks my heart a little bit.
I am not even in the position. I mean, I'm a middle class white girl.
Right.
You know, right. So I'm not in the position even to presume
right.
any of her experiences
right.
or, you know, how she defines herself.
Of course. But have you heard, have you in your work and writings about adoption and your experience obviously is a little bit different, but have you found anybody else who's talking about transracial adoption, like, or any places like you might suggest people who are more interested in this to go?
You know who wrote a beautiful book about this is Jillian Loren.
Okay.
And her book is called Everything You Ever Wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And
so interesting. Such a
Actually, there's a lot of books right now with very similar titles
yeah.
to these. And she's local here in Los Angeles, and she adopted two boys from Ethiopia.
Mm.
And she doesn't write so much about the racial aspect mm-hmm. of it, but she does have that trans racial adoption as well. And just that, well, like, she and her husband probably are going to have to sit down
right.
with them and have the black boy conversation, right. like being, this is what it means to be a black boy.
They
and,
sure are.
You know, or will they have a friend do it for them, right. you know, or will it be a series of conversations right. over right. time?
And that's really hard. I think about my dad, who he was a lot older than most people's dads. So he grew up in the South, or he was born in the South and came to California. And he would always talk to us constantly about, like, do you see how that's racist? Like, do you see? And it was like a constant thing. And as a kid, I was like, you know, it's the 90s, like, racism doesn't exist. Like, you know, it was that whole idea. And now, looking back, I'm like, that was so important and formative for who I am now, like, as I think critically about race in this country. And I wonder, like, for the kids that you're talking about, is, like, it's not just one conversation, right? It's like a lifetime of understanding what it means to be. I just am so curious about transracial adoptions now. Like, think the more I think about it, the more questions I have. So I will definitely check that book out, because that's like...
It's a beautiful book too. She's such a beautiful writer.
I love that. Yeah, okay. I do want to move, I guess, off the trans. I mean, I don't want to. I could literally talk about this for the next like 7 days straight. But we touched on this so quickly last week about the stigma around birth parents and how people kind of dismiss their experience by just saying, like, it's the most loving thing you can do. Like, you're a hero, but then actually shun them and treat them poorly. And one of the things that came up in your book and Nicole's book is that in the hospital, the adoptive parents, or the, I guess, well, tell me, had you already adopted Grace by the time she was, how does that
so
work?
So how it works, it's a series, it's a staged. Okay. So, which gives the birth parents time to change their mind, which is huge, so important, like such an important
that like grace part period of it.
There
if
is
they
a grace
to.
Period. It's very nerve wracking
for the
birth parents, yeah. but you know what, or for the adoptive parents, but so what? Like, right. that's not, you're not the important part right. of this right now.
Right.
Yeah. So we only had 4 days to start getting paperwork and stuff done when we met Bridget. Mm-hmm. So we met her on a Friday and Grace was born on a Tuesday. Okay. And so you get time in between, but she was also in the hospital from, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And in that time, they had tried to change her mind. Or just see how committed she was to doing this. So first, you know, we would come and we would visit the baby and we would visit them and we'd bring them stuff. And so, like, it probably seemed like we were family members mm-hmm. or something. But then once they learned that they were placing Grace for adoption, it became a different story. They took Bridget aside, apart from Bill, and grilled her for...
Bill is Grace's biological father.
To make sure that she wasn't coerced into okay. it. But they also, in a way, treated her like a child, like she didn't know her own mind. Like she said, no, this is something that I want to do. I'm not ready to be a parent. This isn't right for me. But it was very, like, the way they did it was really just not understanding, not loving, right. almost hateful.
Towards Bill and Bridget or towards you and Peter?
I would say both. Toward the whole situation. Like, they, you know, they threatened to, you know, put her in CPS, you know, or something, like in foster care, you know, just, and this was after we'd, you know, they had signed all the paperwork saying right. these are the intended parents right. for this child. And so it was really traumatic for them because, A, it's a hard enough decision to make for a lot of people anyway. I can't say it was a very difficult decision for them, but it's a painful
right.
decision to make. Right. And then to have people grilling you
right.
about it and second guessing you and,
right.
you know, but they, you know, in all fairness, like they probably do need to say, like, these are the resources available for you if you decide to parent,
right.
you know, so you can,
yeah.
you know, but they, you know,
I just feel like, I mean, in my mind, in my thinking, you don't make the decision to give your child up for adoption lightly. Like, it's not something that you're just like, oh, I'm going to just do this. Like, and so the idea that, like, at this point now, we're here, the child has been born, the papers have been signed, like this idea that all of a sudden, you know, now I'm going to be like, oh, I actually didn't think about this at all. And, you know, of course, people do change their mind. And I agree, it's important to have that window in case that's something that needs to happen. But, like, to be condescending or, like, patronizing.
Yeah, they were treated very badly.
Yeah, and yeah. Nicole talks about that also in her book, that her birth parents were also kind of like pulled aside and they tried to make sure and they weren't into her adoptive parents. I didn't know that was something that happened.
Yeah, and then Nicole's book too, like, I think there was still a little bit of a mystery around, you know, like, was it the, like, did the dad really want to, the birth dad really want to keep her, you know? And she had that longing question, like that really lingering question of, was I wanted?
It's hard because on one side, I have to imagine that you feel extremely wanted by your parents, right? You've grown up your life hearing your adoption story or your myth or whatever, your connection to your parent. And then on the other side, that opens the door for feeling like you weren't wanted.
Right.
So like on both, that there are these humans in the world who didn't want you. And then there's these other humans in the world who you were the only thing that could make their life feel full. And like that also must be hard because they are so extreme. It's not so like I kind of wanted you and I kind of didn't. Like it's like you made my life and you were something that I didn't want at all. Right. And like, I mean, not that it's either of those things.
And again, like that's why it's so important to tell children the truth, I think. And, you know, in the age appropriate, loving way,
like, of course.
Like they, and I do tell this to Grace, and it's true. It is true that they loved her.
Right.
But they were in no way ready to be parents.
Right.
You know, and she knows this. She visited them being homeless. Like she's been in their tent.
Right.
She knows that they.
Right.
That was not a lifestyle for her.
And even with that, something that came up in your book and in Nicole, there's so many parallels, honestly, which I was more surprised to find because yours comes from the perspective of the parent. Hers comes from the perspective of the child. But obviously in my naivete, I thought like that they would be very different. But in both books, there's a lot of talk about like kind of guilt and insecurity. And one of the things that I thought was super interesting about your book is that came across for me was your feeling like, oh, are Bill and Bridget gonna think that I'm a good parent? Or like that I, and then on the flip side, like they're homeless and they're living in a tent. And of course, they think you're a great parent because you're doing for them what they were not going to be able to do for themselves. But just that feeling of like uncertainty about your own ability, I guess.
Well, it's also that feeling of an unrepayable debt.
Sure.
Like, how do I repay? And this is probably why I was so bad with boundaries and et cetera. Like, you know, how do you repay a debt that you can, and people are like, oh, well, you did something for them. You gave their child a home. Like, no, you know what?
Right.
Like, there's probably 5,000 people that would have scooped up that baby right behind me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that because I was special.
Right.
It's because I was lucky,
right.
You know, and I happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Right.
And there is that feeling of like, how do I do right by them?
Right.
How do I do right by this child?
Right. Do you feel like those feelings of kind of, I don't know. I don't know if it's exactly insecurity. Does that sound true
to
you?
I'm not insecure in my parenting, but I will definitely say like when they were staying with us, they had a front row seat to it.
Right.
And, you know, just like anybody, like even if like my own mother was like in my, like she'd have a front row seat and that probably wouldn't go down very well either.
Right.
You know?
Totally.
So.
Yeah. But those feelings and in All You Can Ever Know, Nicole talks about kind of her own guilt about reaching out. And like what that did to her sister, Cindy, and Jessica also, and the parent and her biological parents, like what, and her adoptive parents, like how her actions made changes that she felt like responsible for and felt guilt around, which I just thought was so interesting because then once she starts connecting with her birth father, he constantly like apologizes to her and is saying, I'm so sorry. And he's expressing his remorse. Of course, when I put myself in anyone's position in the triad, I understand that, but I never really realized how much like regret or guilt or insecurity or whatever you want to call those feelings. And I think there's probably a lot. And also you said like you were lucky and like that there's also something attached to that that's like you feel undeserving or not undeserving, but like unspecial. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm saying
sure
it right.
I'm sure there's a German word for it.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I don't feel like I have the right word for it again, but that there's this sense of like, this happened to me and it was out of my control and I'm so grateful for it. But like, why me kind of feeling for everyone in the situation. And it just was really powerful as she kind of explains her own thinking around it. And it kind of confused me a little bit because I guess I wasn't I don't know what I was expecting going into the book. I wish I had taken like a journal entry, but I read it immediately after reading your book, and those things really stuck out to me as like part of the experience.
And I think Nicole did such a good job of explaining that duality, you know, right. And that it is messy, and you know, you expect it's going to be one thing,
right?
But it is just multi-layered,
right?
Multi-hued,
right?
Messy. Just it's not a clean thing,
right?
And she did a good job in describing
and like letting it be messy,
and just you just got to let it be messy. Yeah. But that's also makes it a better book,
right?
She would not have a book if it was like, I met my birth parents. We all went on a picnic.
Right.
It was great.
We ate Korean food and now I speak fluent Korean.
The like, end.
Exactly.
I mean, no book there. You
right.
know?
Totally. And what did you think about her relationship or no relationship with her biological mother?
That part. So, you know, I am not a Korean adoptee.
Right.
So, and I was not raised in her situation.
Sure,
so
sure.
I'm just going to say like,
that goes for both of us times like 1,000, just if you were worried.
Yeah. So, you know, and also like, just like what I would have done is not what she would, it frustrated me just as a reader that, cause I really wanted to hear from the mom, you know, but just as a reader, you know,
right.
just as that like curiosity,
sure, of course.
But I can understand like, she just was not in a place to hear that. She felt like there was just so much ruined in her sister's lives and, you know, in her own life in a way because of this woman who was abusive and
right.
mean and, you know, now regretful, I guess, in her older years. But I would have loved to just hear that side of it. But that was not Nicole's place
right.
at that time.
I know. I wonder. I'm with you. Like I just would have loved to hear more from the mom as a reader observer, just like to make the story in my mind more complete. But I'm sure if you're Nicole, that is part of her story that also probably feels a little bit incomplete for her. But she made a choice to be Cindy's sister. And Cindy is the love of my life. I just love Cindy.
I do too.
Like the part where she's like, asks her to be her sister.
I know.
That's the
I know.
Part where I wanted to cry and I couldn't get it out.
I basically, I'm like fluttering on that one.
That
I mean,
moment.
Here's the thing though. Like the mom, just back to the mom and then to Cindy, the mom was a main character in the book, but
right.
we never heard from her.
Right.
But Cindy, it was so gratifying to get to know her and to see how loving she was. Like, she could have been really resentful. She
right.
could have turned out horrible. But you know what? Nicole probably would have turned out pretty great, too,
right.
if she was with Cindy.
Right.
You know, if she
right.
had gone with Cindy.
Right. Cindy. I just love Cindy. And I loved, like, their husbands talking yeah. about like their similarities. I thought that was so great because I could just imagine myself in the room being like, oh my god, you guys just did the same thing, like, oh my god, you guys are twins. Like, but yes, I loved the way that they both approached their sisterhood, and I just thought it was so powerful to have these two adult women choose one another as sisters, because yes, they share the same DNA, but they weren't raised as sisters. That's like meeting someone and just saying like, I'm committing to you.
I met my older brother when I was 16 for the first time.
Did you?
He grew up in Israel.
Oh,
and right. his from my father's first marriage, and he was kidnapped and taken there by her when he was 3. So I grew up hearing about him, and like, he was like this sort of like mythical, you know, spirit child,
right.
you know, but when we met, it was this instant connection. So that really resonated for me
right.
when Nicole met Cindy.
Right.
You know,
and
just that same feeling of like DNA. Oh, look, we kind of have the same jaw.
Right.
You know, and he looks so much like my dad. And, you know, even today we're super close and
right.
I love him to death. And he's in Israel.
Right.
But I just, you know, I do feel that kinship with him.
Right. And like, you, I guess, get to choose your sibling, kind of. Like, because there's another world where you could have met your brother and you guys, I guess, like, you know, would have had that same connection, but you could have said, but, you know, this guy's just like a distant relative, right? Like, that there's like a choice to stay connected. Or did you not even feel that? You just felt...
Definitely there was, we just stayed connected, but he is like Nicole in a way because he didn't grow up with his father. So mm-hmm. he has a lot of questions. Right. He also like grew up hearing bad things about my father.
Sure.
And so, you know, there's a lot, I think, that's unresolved for Ilya.
Yeah.
That, you know, that he didn't grow up with us. He didn't grow up in America. He right. didn't, you know, right. he didn't have, you know, the same experience that we did.
Wow. I didn't even put that together. And of course you talk about it in your book, but I now that you're saying this, I'm like mind blown. So the other thing that happens in Nicole's book is that she has a daughter. She ends up having another daughter, but
Gracie.
Yeah. Which is another connection. It's funny. We always pick these books and I've usually not read them when I pick them. And there's been so many times where we've picked a book and there's been like super parallels. Like we had an author on a few months ago in the book we read, both of their books had flowers on the cover and it was told from 5 different characters' perspectives and it covered 25 years. It was like just so weird that they connected. And that's kind of like same with this. So she becomes pregnant. And that's kind of part of her impetus for wanting to actually seek out her birth parents because she wants to be able to give her daughter some information. Kind of she veils it a little bit as like, just want to know about our medical history. But obviously, you know, if you're reading the book, you know there's more there. But she says this thing about like she can't believe that she's going to be biologically related to someone. And I just thought like, wow. I think I take that so for granted in my own life that like I have my family that I was born into is the family that raised me. But hearing her say that like really was like a perspective check for me. And the other thing about her having her daughter that she talks about that I so appreciate is that she talked about all of her anxiety around childbirth and being pregnant and becoming a mom in a really vulnerable way that I feel like people don't talk about. Like, what is going to happen to me when I go into labor and like all that stuff?
You know, I would say that was probably my least favorite part of the book, like the anxiety part. I don't know. I felt like I'm sure, obviously, she's having those right. feelings and she right. had it, but that felt like the least, that was my least favorite part of it.
That's so interesting.
Because I felt like we know, like she's going to have the baby, she's going to be fine. She's right. like, you know, she's like the anxiety stuff to me. I don't know. I felt like it wasn't as necessary as the rest of it, like the big ponderous questions
sure.
and also the little, and then I love the part about Cindy wanting to be her sister, but you know, like you knew she was going to say yes.
Yeah,
like you
course.
Knew that. Like of I was course. Like, why is she anxious about it? Like, she's going to say yes. But that, I mean, that's
I'm
her,
sure in the moment.
That's her, yeah. that's her feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I feel like that those are probably huge questions for anyone who's making
yeah.
And like, so I take my biology for granted as well. Like I can tell you about like my great grandparents
right.
and you know, all that stuff. And Grace is not going to have that much of her.
Right.
I mean, her story is my story because she is in our family.
Right. Right.
You know, but she's not going to have that piece of it.
That piece. Like when she finds out that she's like the 19th generation, I was like, whew, that's yeah. amazing. But also I feel that way as a Black person. Like, I don't know. I don't even know my like fourth generation, you know, for other reasons. But I think that I would imagine that if I could find out 19 generations of the Thomas family, I would be like, it would be mind-blowing.
Amazing.
Like, that's so incredible.
But I mean, does anybody really know 19 generations?
Right, that's what I, yeah,
that's
I mean,
like a very uncommon
right. But even like
thing.
10 or like 8, I don't know. I tried to do Ancestry, whatever.com, like where you find your family. And I think I got to my dad and then I got to my grandma and grandpa. And that was it. I couldn't get further back. I got names and that's it. Like, so like 19 to me, I'm like, I'd take 6,
yeah,
4.
Yeah, no, I would too. I don't, yeah.
yeah. I think that the anxiety around the pregnancy thing, what I appreciated, not that it was so intrinsic to the story, but just that she was talking about it, kind of in the ways that she talked about her other anxieties and other like things that stressed her out that were more part of like around her adoption. I just like the vulnerability because I feel like so many people like with pregnancy are like, oh yeah, I'm pregnant. It's great. It's the best thing ever. And like that there's also parts of that like for women that's really challenging and confusing and terrifying. And there's this responsibility that – you know, you don't know. And then I also died for Brenda, her like birth coach's son. Do you remember? He like pops in for 30 seconds and I took a note that was like, please write your next book about just Brenda's son. Like the kid who's in this like woo-woo. Like. So I guess, I mean, we're kind of winding down, but I do always love to talk about the title and the cover. So what did you, what do you think of the title, All You Can Ever Know?
So I actually really like this title mm-hmm. because I felt it was so intrinsic to her questions. Like, how much do I know?
Right.
This is all I can ever know. Oh, wait,
right.
maybe it's
maybe there's
not.
More.
Yeah, maybe there's more. Right. I thought it was beautiful. And like the beautiful symbology of the, you know, like the kind of frayed root mm-hmm. there and like a family tree and, you know, sort of the little sprout. I thought,
right.
yeah, I thought it was lovely. I thought her cover was pitch perfect. And I thought the title is pitch perfect.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds like a lot of other books
right,
right now, like we're having a moment of, you know, yeah. choose one from column A, one from
yeah,
column B.
Yeah, totally.
One, all you can, yeah, yeah. Everything you ever wanted to know.
Yeah.
All you can ever know. And
yeah, I agree. I really like the title. I love the navy blue. For some reason, that color. More than the tree branches or roots. I just love that, the blue and the white the of
navy,
the cover.
Navy blue is a color of credibility mm. as well, like psychologically. It's yeah. like, that's why a lot of politicians have navy blue and white or navy blue and yellow. But it is like a very solid, grounded, yeah. like, so that's like a very grounding
yeah.
color.
It's true, because I felt like I trusted her from the beginning, and maybe that's part of it, the psychology around that cover. In the title... I didn't actually think about it the way that you said, like, is this all I can ever know? Like, that wasn't the way that I interpreted
what,
it.
How did you interpret it?
I think I thought of it more of like, I want to know all I can ever know. Not like, is this the limit? But
when
more
you talk
like,
to her, will you ask her?
I will. I love to ask about title and cover are like almost always some of my favorite. I won't give away the title of your book because when that reveal happens in your book, it was one of my favorite parts. And like you said, your cover is an Instagram photo of your daughter, which I love your cover. But yeah, is there anything else you want to say about this book?
You know, I just feel like she was so brave. Mm-hmm. I feel like she's going to find such an amazing sisterhood mm-hmm. and, you know, among people, it's, you know, men too, but people who, you know, were in very similar situations.
Right.
You know, I just wish the best for her and yeah. her kids and Cindy and, you know, her whole family. She was just super brave and super beautiful in writing this book.
I could not agree more. And I like I said earlier, like, I hope that this opens up more space for people to talk about their transracial adoptions. I'm just so fascinated by that. And also for people to talk about finding their birth parents and it being less than their imagination as a child, or more complicated, or I think like finding out that your birth mother was abusive is like, that's a whole lot. And I feel like she talks about a little bit, like in all the movies, it's like you find your birth parent and either you fall in love with them or you murder them. And like, but this is like somewhere in between.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do hope that this book opens more of that conversation around like your fantasy and the reality of the situation and the complexity of like adoption isn't the greatest thing you can ever do / you're a terrible person for doing it. Like that there's so much more subtlety and yeah, I agree with you.
I know. We should figure out how to go to lunch with her.
I know. She's in New York. I'm like, can you come and hang out soon? Just some gals want to talk books. Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for being here. And everybody, you can get her book, Rock Needs River. It's out. It's in the world now. So check it out. It's beautiful. And then, of course, All You Can Ever Know by Nicole Chung. Thank you, Vanessa.
Tracy, thank you so much.
And we'll see you guys in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you to our guest, Vanessa McGrady, for joining. Also, check out our conversation with Nicole Chung, author of All You Can Ever Know, on the Short Stacks. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media, at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to the show, like perks and our virtual book club, go to patreon.com/thestacks to join the fun. For one-time contributions, you can always go to paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, will you take a moment to rate and review the show? Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. I will see you in the stacks.